Computers and human beings generate digital data at the rate of 1,000 billion bytes every hour. That's more bytes than stars in the average galaxy, and there are more of them every hour of every day. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. The big bang of data in all aspects of our professional and personal lives is sometimes overwhelming. Where it comes to the drug development pipeline, when time matters to patients with cancer and rare diseases, researchers must struggle to keep current with the multiplying volume of information, from peer-reviewed scientific research, patent filings, clinical trials data, news, competitive briefs, and much, much more. Machine learning algorithms go a long way to managing the burden, of course. Yet the founder of a leading developer of text analytics solutions is confident that machine learning is not yet able to displace the learning done by human beings. Lee Harlan earned a PhD in genetics from King's College London and worked for more than 15 years in life sciences leading semantic web, data integration, and text mining efforts. He founded SciByte in 2013, and while the firm has won awards for its technology, Lee Harlan is an enthusiastic advocate of what he calls human curation. He joins me now from his office at the Wellcome Trust Genome Campus in Cambridge, England. Welcome to Beyond the Book, Lee Harlan.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're looking forward to this discussion because at this particular moment in the press, there is this notion that the robots are beginning to push human beings out of the picture. But from what I understand from your own work experience, Lee, that's not quite the case. And in fact, it probably never will be because human curation, as you put it, is always going to be essential, even as we move deeper and deeper into a world of machine learning.
Yeah, I think, you know, it can't escape anybody that the machine learning and artificial intelligence is really, the top of the hype right now. And at SciByte, certainly machine learning is something we use every day. So, for me, it's a great technology. It's very exciting. But I think it also goes alongside lots of other things that exist in that, and particularly the contribution from, kind of scientific knowledge, existing experts in the domain, and how they can bring that to bear on some of these algorithms and analyses that people want to do to gain insight into data.
Right. So for our listeners, Lee, who don't, as you do, work with machine learning every day, let's define a couple of terms here. When it comes to data, as I understand it, there are two types, essentially. There's structured data and unstructured data. And it's the unstructured data that's the real critical piece to this and the most challenging piece.
Yeah. So you can think of structured data as numbers in a spreadsheet. When you kind of know what the experiment was, you know what the columns are, you know what the rows are, you know what the data is. It could be, the progression of a certain thing over time, it could be the growth or the reduction or whatever. But you've got measurements, essentially. And computers can generally understand that data. But a lot of the information, and you mentioned the growth in things like scientific articles and patents and publications and internal documents in companies. A lot of this is just text, and computers don't understand text. They just see strings of letters. They don't really know what it means. So if they see the letter M-O-U-S-E, they don't know it means mouse, and they don't know that's referring to an animal or specifically to a rodent. And they don't know any other document that mentions other types of rodent. They just don't understand this. So the ethos of SciByte has been to take this, what's called unstructured data, and try and turn it into more like this structured information. Try and represent that data in a technical way that allows computers to say, aha, this document is about a mouse, it's about a rodent, or it's about a gene, it's about a specific type of disease. And once the computer understands that, you can then compute. You can then do really exciting stuff with the data that you can't do with just a bunch of raw documents.
And you need to do that right at the beginning, right? You need to put it into that kind of structured format so that it's searchable, it's clean, if you will, and you have to do that before you begin the process of using machine learning.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of different approaches. Certainly, there are quite a few experiments now where people can just take raw documents and throw them into machine learning algorithms and do interesting stuff. That is certainly not an invalid way forward. There are many experiments you can do. But equally, there are a lot of experiments that you want to do in a data science capacity that require you to really understand a little bit more about the content of the document. So again, you know, coming down to, you know, kind of machine learning, you know, is there... We often say that, you know, from Scibyte, we're actually, you know, Scibyte really big proponents of machine learning. I say we use it every day and our customers use it. And one of the things we're trying to do is get the, you know, solve the garbage in, garbage out problem. You know, if you're putting, you know, random, lots and lots of random data into machine learning, it's good, but it may not be that good. Whereas if you can, you know, go a little bit further and, you know, pre-treat your data so that it's, you know, a bit more structured, a bit more organized, and then feed that to these algorithms. We've seen time and time again with our customers that these then start, you know, these algorithms start performing much better. So again, it's, you know, the quality of what you get out is directly related to the quality of what you put in.
Right. Well, we are speaking right now with Lee Harlan. He's the founder of Scibyte, based in Cambridge, England. And we're looking at how Scibyte transforms this data into information and then into knowledge. And I guess I want to ask you, what's the secret here? What are the things that are done? I was thinking, even with your example of the mouse, it could be a mouse, it could be a rodent, it could also be a computer mouse. And a computer itself, a machine learning algorithm, wouldn't know the difference unless it had some kind of context. And is that what you work on in this human curation? You provide the context, you develop vocabularies and synonyms and definitions.
Yes, that's it. So, and this all really comes under the banner of an ontology. And so, and this is a term that there's a big irony in the world of ontologies that the words ontology, taxonomy, vocabulary, synonyms, etc., are kind of not really well defined, even though the purpose of an ontology is actually to define things properly. But an ontology really is a conceptual knowledge about a particular domain. So, you know, there is a cell ontology, which describes all of the different cell types that exist and their relationships to each other. There's a very, for those people who do study ontologies at university, there's a very famous thing they learn in their first year of university, which is the pizza ontology, which talks about how pizzas are split up into bases and toppings and how those relate to each other. And it's really a conceptual conceptualization in of a particular domain in a computer-readable format. So if we go to the example of a rodent, there is a very a couple of very well-established taxonomies, ontologies of species, which start with things like, you know, all animals, then to eukaryotes, and then to vertebrates, and then to rodents, etc. And so what these do is they provide for a computer a unique code, a unique ID that describes a specific thing, so a rat, a mouse, a human, a dog. But they also organize them, so you know which are rodents, you know which are mammals, you know which are vertebrates. And it's all done in a way that while these things are built by humans, they are completely understandable by a machine. And that is where the power in using ontologies in this kind of context of unstructured data really is brought to bear, because you get to the point where, you know, you've taken your unstructured text, you've taken your ontology of, let's say in this case, animals, you've merged the two. And now what you have is a document where at any point the computer knows not only that an animal is mentioned, but what type of animal. And of course, you can apply this to cells, tissues, diseases, drugs, people, companies, whatever.
Right. And so that curation team is developing all of this. They're disambiguing. They are disambiguizing. Is that the term, Lee Harlan? You could tell me. You know better than I.
Disambiguating.
Disambiguating. Thank you very much. They are disambiguating all of these various terms, which are important. I mean, in the kinds of research that pharmaceutical companies are taking on, knowing precisely which genome, knowing precisely the reaction or the non-reaction to a certain kind of approach or treatment, that's going to matter to drug development. And so your curation team does the disambiguation. It expands as well the vocabularies, and that allows the researchers then to work with all of this data in a way that gets them to the results so much more quickly.
Yeah, so I think there's two elements to this. The first bit is the, you know, the kind of who produces the ontologies. And I think this comes to the heart of the matter, really, which is that, you know, the ontologies, most of the ontologies that we use in this space are produced by a vast community of scientists. So many of the ontologies we make use of at SciByte are produced by the community, by the scientific community, funded by both private and public money across the globe. And at SciByte, we are, you know, consumers and contributors to those. You have initiatives such as the Allotrope Foundation, which is, again, a set of pharmaceutical companies and other partners who've come together to develop these standards for pharmaceutical sciences and processing of drugs. And I think the power is in the openness. The fact that they are done in the public domain, they are free to use by everybody. Because this gets to the heart of why you want to do this. It promotes data interoperability and actually the ability to do these experiments. So, you know, in my previous life working for a major pharma company, we had issues when two different suppliers would provide us with data that was described. And let's say they both had the concept of, you know, mouse or human data in there, but it was described using two different proprietary ontologies. And it's very difficult to work with because it doesn't connect you to any of the public data or any other data. So I think the sort of the first half of the answer to your question was really that the ontologies we work with aren't the result of one, two, three, four people. They're the results of thousands of experts. Everyone contributing a tiny little bit of knowledge to an overall coherent map of, you know, a particular set of cells, tissues, diseases, whatever. And the power to be able to leverage that expertise in a computer-readable format is utterly incredible.
Indeed. I was thinking that the notion of collaboration and community, that's essential to scientific research, because the work that you do, Lee Harlan, in your lab in Cambridge, and the work that I might do at my lab in Boston, Massachusetts, we want to share that information, we want to build on that, and then someone else will come along to build further on our work.
That's exactly it. So, you know, proprietary ontologies, well, they do have a place. You know, really the power of, you know, this big data world is being able to kind of describe, you know, when you describe a mouse and I describe a mouse, the, you know, if we're describing that to a computer, we kind of want to use the same, you know, the same description so the computer can see that we're talking about the same thing. The other half of this, though, you mentioned sort of the disambiguation side. So, when people like, you know, many of the folks at SciByte and many of the people on the team at the Genome Campus here in Cambridge in the UK and across, of course, around the world are building these ontologies, the primary aim is to represent the things. So if you're building an ontology of animals, your primary aim is to represent the list of all the animals and organize them into their correct taxonomical categories. They're less focused on the different applications that people might put those ontologies to, because of course you don't know anyone, you know, people can do lots of different things with these. One of the things that we want to do and what we do at SciByte is take these ontologies and use them to find those concepts within text. And actually, you know, you raised this idea of disambiguation. That's actually quite hard. So, you know, the example I always talk about is hedgehog. We all know the hedgehog is this, you know, nice little spiky animal that ferrets around in the garden late at night. But to many scientists in life sciences, hedgehog is actually better known as the name of a protein, which is absolutely critical in cell division, which is, of course, the major process involved in cancer. So when you say hedgehog to a life scientist, particularly in molecular biology or human genetics, they're much more likely to be thinking about the hedgehog gene or protein and not the lovable animal. And so when you are trying to apply ontologies to text, you've got to do it in an intelligent way. When you see the word hedgehog, you've got to build systems that say, right, okay, this could mean one of two things. So I'm going to have to do a little bit more work to work out what it exactly is. I'm not going to annotate it as the hedgehog protein unless I really think it is. And similarly, I'm not going to, you know, annotate it as the hedgehog animal unless there's something that tells me, you know, that it is the animal. And that's disambiguation. So when you apply ontologies to text, you can't just do it in a naive way. You've got to have a layer of intelligence that really kind of tries to understand exactly what that word means.
Because when you apply the machine learning algorithms and so forth, what the researcher is after is scientifically interesting results, and all that work you've just described are going to lead us there.
That's exactly right. And of course, this is where, you know, this isn't a kind of a battle of AI, sort of machine learning versus non-machine learning, because actually at Scibyte, we use a lot of machine learning techniques to build the disambiguation inside ontologies. So these, you know, these things are not, you know, polar opposites. This is an ecosystem of technology where, you know, kind of applying the right technology at the right time is what you want to do. But, you know, so you can use kind of machine learning to actually help build these really deep layers of disambiguation and rules for applying ontologies. And then, of course, you can apply the ontologies to extract out really cool data. And then you can push that back to machine learning to, you know, to do some nice analytics. So, you know, I think the point is that, you know, they're not, you know, these things are not opposed to each other. It's more, you know, the two combined give you an incredible power that, you know, up until a few years ago was just not, you know, available.
Right. And rather than being afraid of artificial intelligence, the work that you're taking on at Scibyte, Lee Harlan, and the work that goes on around you at that genome campus, it must be thrilling to be living at this particular moment in science when the kinds of results you can get combining the human curation and the machine learning are just going to lead us to cure diseases and to solve problems that were beyond our ken in the past.
Well, I think it certainly is an exciting time. I have in my team, I've got a couple of people who did PhDs in machine learning and artificial intelligence in sort of 20 years ago, and they're bittersweet because they're loving the fact that, you know, their skills are now seen as very important. They're also annoyed that for 20 years people just ignored them and you know, didn't think they did anything that interesting with their lives. But now, of course, they're sort of, you know, the people of the year. But this is where the hype comes in. So I think, you know, what you see a lot now, and, you know, this is expected of any new technology. We saw it with semantic web. We've seen it with many other things, that, you know, the hype has almost gone ahead of what's, you know, real and sensible. And our experience has been, you know, that if you cut away the hype and you look at what we're doing, what our partners in different companies are doing, what our customers are doing, the actual you know, use of kind of machine learning and ontology based sort of technologies, you can now do some quite powerful stuff. You know, it's not, you know, yet kind of, you know, giving you the magic phone app where you type in your symptoms and it suddenly gives you the cure to your disease, but little things like, you know, and I guess I can talk a few about some of the examples that I can tell you. Little things, you know, the sort of the stepping stones to the, you know, the broader picture. So I think my message is that, you know, right now, machine learning isn't this magic bullet that in 2 years' time is going to solve all our problems. But it is a technology to be taken seriously and actually has had some real impacts in, you know, in some of the things we do.
Well, we appreciate your perspective, Lee Harlan, and certainly have learned a great deal by chatting with you today. We've been speaking with Lee Harlan. He's the founder of Scibyte, based at the Wellcome Trust Genome Campus in Cambridge, England. Lee Harlan, thank you for joining me on Beyond the Book.
Thank you very much.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global leader in content management, discovery, and document delivery solutions. Through its relationships with those who use and create content, CCC and its subsidiaries RightsDirect and Ixis drive market-based solutions that accelerate knowledge, power publishing, and advance copyright. Beyond the Book co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. I'm Christopher Keneally. Join us again soon on Beyond the Book.